Hello and welcome to today's Zenith Bank PLC full year 2014 results conference call. For the first part of this call, all participants are on a listen-only mode, so there's no need to mute your own individual lines, and afterwards there'll be a question and answer session. Just to inform you, the call is being recorded. I'll now hand over to our host, Peter Imangbo, CEO of Zenith Bank PLC.
Good afternoon. And welcome to our 2014 conference call for Zenith Bank PLC. My name is Peter Mangoze, the CEO of the bank. I have with me here this afternoon Ebenezer Onyago, Executive Director. I have Shola Oladipo, Executive Director. I have Mike Anyima, Head of our Investor Relations, General Manager. I have Stanley Amuche, is our Chief Financial Officer, and I have Felix Ebo, our Chief Risk Officer. So welcome. I'm very delighted to be addressing you this afternoon. And I just want to say that 2014 had been a mixed year with its challenges and at the same time numerous opportunities. In perspective, that 2014 has been a very good year for Zenith Bank. We issued our maiden Eurobond in April 2014 with a $1 billion program. We went for $500 million, and I'm happy to say that it was oversubscribed by about 200%. And this helped the bank in increasing and improving our dollar liquidity, which enabled us to play actively in the upstream oil and gas market and in other sectors where dollar is generated. In terms of business generally, we grew across all sectors. And at the end of 2014, I'm happy to announce that we recorded a 15% increase in our gross revenue. Deposit liability grew by about 12%, and our loans grew by 37%. Looking at the outlook for 2015, as it is, will portend a lot of challenges and at the same time opportunities for the bank. We see potentials for growth across different sectors. Principal among these, I have the petrochemical sector, which I'll term in the midstream, manufacturing, specifically FMCG cement and other manufacturing concerns. Also in the service area, technology, IT, and general commerce. We believe that we are equal to the task, and going by our performance of 2014, we believe that 2015 will even be a better year. Recall that we gave guidance on different parameters in 2014. And I'm happy to announce that in terms of delivery and our results, we've actually delivered on most of those parameters. If you look at our return on equity of 18.7, it's consistent with what we guided. Our NPL dropped to 1.8% from 2.9 in 2013. Our cost of risk also came down to 0.9 from 0.97. And if you look at our deposit growth, if you look at our PBT, we guided 120 and we delivered 120. So in conclusion, I will say 2015, we will deliver on different parameters, and we expect that we will have increase across all the income parameters. We have a guidance of PBT of about 6% growth, deposit growth of between 10% to 15%. Our cost to income, we have been striving to improve on this, and I'll say we're actually recording a lot of success in this regard. We expect that our cost to income ratio will drop to about 56.5, thereabout, worst case scenario, and our return on equity should be about 19.6%. I want to pause at this point and allow opportunities for questions, and we'll be able to answer these questions. Thank you very much. questions?
Okay, if you would like to ask a question, please dial 01 on your telephone keypad now to enter the queue. Once your name is announced, you can ask your question. If you find your question is answered before it's your turn to speak, you can dial 02 to cancel your question at any point. So once again, it's 01 to ask a question, or 02 if you need to cancel. There'll be a brief pause now whilst your questions are registered. Okay, so far we have six questions in the queue. The first is from Lauren Beluro of Primera Africa. Go ahead, your line is open.
All right, good afternoon. Congrats on a good earnings performance. So just a few things. What percentage of your loan book is in U.S. dollars or in Forex? And then also your guidance for loan growth in 2015. With the tough economic outlook, you'd be quite interested to see growth for your loan book, and actually what particular sectors do you think would drive that loan growth in 2015? And also in regards to loan book, based on what we see with the dollar, has there been any request to convert your dollar loans to Naira? And that'll be all for now. Thank you.
Stanley, can I take the first part of the question?
Okay, good. The portion of our balance sheet that is in foreign currency is about 29% of our balance sheet that is in foreign currency. What you asked about the areas we are looking at for growth, especially in loans, we expect growth from most of the sectors, the very critical sectors of the economy. We are expecting growth in the petrochemical sector, the agri. We are looking at areas like the manufacturing, especially fast-moving and consumables, more like cement and all that. So those are the areas we feel that growth will come from, especially in the asset creation side of it.
Thank you. And to answer the last two parts of your question, in terms of guidance for loan growth, we are looking at 15 to 20%. You also asked if we had requests for conversion of our dollar loans to Naira. I will tell you that most of our dollar loans that we have, those customers generate dollar flows. So we don't even have much challenge in terms of customers coming to ask for conversion. So I will ask in a nutshell that, yes, we had very, very few customers, but they are mainly short-term transactions, like customers who are into general commerce, who normally will borrow in dollars for 90 days import transactions. Thank you.
Okay. Now, 15 to 20%, you say cement and FMCG. It's quite bullish, I mean, amidst what we're seeing so far in the market. I mean, we're almost into the third month of the year, and with elections, we don't expect much to happen in the first 6 months. So are you telling us that by the end of this year, you should see around 50% loan growth?
I would tell you that even this fourth quarter of the year, the demand for loans is huge. And it's very important. So when we talk about loans in this industry, it's not just about term loans to increase capacity. In terms of working capital, we have quite a lot of demand even as we speak now. So talking about 15 to 20% in terms of loan growth, I would even say it's very, very conservative. If we want to be bullish, we can even achieve double what we have, because the demand for loans, especially by the big names, the big corporates, the multinationals, is increasing. Recall that even with the devaluation of the currency itself, it simply means that for every dollar, you require more naira. So naturally, you will have that increase in terms of loan growth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Bunmi Afalu of FBN Capital. Go ahead, your line is open.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for the presentation and congrats for a great set of numbers. If I could start with your loan-to-deposit ratio. So it touched 68% in December. I think this is the highest I've seen in a while, maybe even in a decade, off the back of the very strong loan growth in Q4. And what was actually even more remarkable is that you could argue that most of your deposit growth actually was matched by an increase in your cash line. So the loan growth still grew despite all that deposit growth being taken away by cash. So first of all, how much of the 13% Q&Q growth was underlying genuine demand, and how much of that was FX translation effect? Then, given that LTD ratio is quite high now, are you beginning to, or have you changed your internal limits on risk / liquidity? Because historically, your LTD ratios were, you know, wake up the next day was 55 to 60%. So has that changed? Are you now a little bit more aggressive? Then moving on to the next question, if you could clarify whether or not FX trading played a major role in boosting your non-interest income, because I can see that credit-related fees and COT were very strong in Q4, but if you could just comment on FX trading. And then finally, your COT revenue is still being super resilient. You're working in magic still, but are you concerned that 27 billion number for the full year will go to zero next year? Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. In terms of the loan growth, I will tell you that 10%, you could say, is attributable to the devaluation of the currency. So 27% is actual loan growth. I think that will address that. I'm talking about the loan-to-deposit ratio. In terms of strategy, you will recall that 75% of public sector funds is now sterilized by way of cash reserve requirement. And in Zenith Bank, we've always had this policy that 100% of our public sector funds will go into treasury bills, amongst others. So naturally, with 100% sterilized, you will expect that we have to compensate from other areas, and that will have accounted for the increase in our loan to deposit ratio. So to answer your question, in terms of strategy, it has not changed. We are still very conservative, but what we've done is to move slightly higher towards creation of risk assets, because the opportunities in the treasury bills market is curtailed by the 70% CRR. The FX trading contributed largely to our non-interest-based income. In Q4, we had a lot of opportunities in terms of FX trading, and we took advantage of that too. And for the COT, we had very strong COT. Naturally, once you have a devaluation, it simply means that the volume of Naira you need will also increase. And this will translate into even increase in your commission. So you'll find out that COT naturally will grow for every FX transaction that you consummate. Thank you.
So just to pick up on the COT point, yeah, I hear that. It's just that obviously that number is going to zero in the next 12 to 15 months. So doesn't that worry you a bit?
Well, it's naturally just like any other player in the industry. This is not the first time we are going to have something like this. Remember that we started from 5 per mil to 3 per mil to 2 per mil. Now we are trending downward. It's not something that is going to take us unawares. We've been aware of this because it's been announced over 2 years ago. So we are working towards it, and we believe that we'll compensate in other areas, just the same way that we've done in the last 2 years.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Ronan Cardia of Exotic. Go ahead, your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much for the questions. Just really a follow-up to the previous question. I mean, how should we be looking at your non-interest income line over the next couple of years? Obviously, 2014 was hugely boosted by the FX trading revenue. There's still the COT in there. So how should we see that line item growing over the next couple of years? And the second question there is, what's your cost of risk guidance for this year? And in particular, what kind of pressure are you seeing from your non-oil business? Because that's typically the part of the portfolio that should be more impacted by the macroeconomic conditions.
Well, I'll say for starters, in terms of the FX trading income and the COT, just like any other player in the industry, once that is gone, as I said, we are going to look at other ways of generating this income. And there are quite a number of areas. We are much more aggressive in terms of fees for credit-related transactions. In terms of our bonds and guarantees, the fees and commissions too we're increasing the volume and we're earning more fees and commission along this line. COT, naturally, we've always planned for that based on the current pronouncement by the central bank. So to that extent, I'll actually say, yes, we would have preferred COT not to go, but the reality is that the COT will be gone. So there's nothing much we can do in that particular regard. On the second question, where you asked about our non-oil and gas business because of the macroeconomic conditions, if you look at our loan book, the preponderance of our customers, our top users of funds, are the big corporates and other industry leaders. And when there's going to be a shake-up in most of the sectors, these are the last people that will be affected. Quite a number of them, the good news is that they are still growing. The demand for loans is still on the rise. Some of the large multinationals are even still requesting for facilities for expansion. So we are very, very comfortable. And we even believe that we will continue to pick and choose the type of transactions that we want to go into based on the demand that we currently have, which I would say is very, very strong.
Right. So what should we expect in terms of cost of risk this year?
The cost of risk, we expect that it will still be maximum 1%. We closed at 0.9 the last time, and we expect that we expect about the same level this time around.
Okay. And just briefly, on your capital adequacy and your dividend payout ratio, we saw quite a big drop from a Basel 1 to Basel 2 basis. If you could just give a brief explanation as to what was the, you know, what caused such a big drop, and what impact is it likely to have on your payout ratio going forward?
Stanley, please, can you?
Okay. You will notice that in 2013, the disclosure was for Basel 1, capital
sure.
adequacy, and Basel 2 in 2014. And the additional things that came in was the operational risk and the market risk, and then the credit risk. Now we had our loan increased, as you noted rightly, and that had its own impact on the capital adequacy, especially for the credit risk. Then additionally, the impact of the operational risk, which is based on the turnover, more like the gross earnings of the bank and group, and that also had some impact. Market risk was minimal because we were not keeping our positions as well for year end and all that. So basically, these are the items or the components that really affected, not caused the drop, the seeming decrease. However, for dividend payouts, well, we're quite capitalized if you compare to the statutory requirement for a bank of our size and our kind of operation. So we're able to we'll fall within the category based on CBN classification that we're able to pay dividend based on our own discretion. More like we can only be restricted by our own internal guidance. You know, so CBN came out with a circular, you know, guiding banks on how you pay based on your risk level, your NPL ratio, and your capital adequacy and all that. We meet the best criteria there, and we're able to take decisions on the level of dividend we pay.
Okay, so should we still expect payout ratios to be closer to 50%?
Yeah, I think it's closer to 60. I think it's quite close. I think it's been disclosed already.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank
okay.
You.
Our next question comes from George Bodo of EcoBank Capital. Go ahead, sir. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of concerns here on my end. One is I just want to take you back on the guidance you've given on your year-on-year loan growth. For 2015, just one line item out of that. You're not seeing a scale down of in capex and overdraft request from upstream players that you are currently exposed on, and you're not seeing some scale down in the budgetary allocations for the borrowing plan. Sorry.
So I think from what I explained before, there's no way you can expect a slowdown or a scale down. If you are talking about from an exchange rate of 160 on the average, you are looking at about 199 now. Automatically, your working capital needs will increase, especially if you are importing any item at all. So you will not see any scale there. And I'm telling you, from what you have seen, even Q1, the demand is still rising. Thank you.
Okay. And the second question is, how much money was sitting with the CBN sterilized as at the close of the year?
Yeah, we had about 508 billion. That was all sitting with CBN.
Okay. And any exposure to marginal indigenous players that is causing concerns for you because, you know, with the oil price plunge and all the reserve-based lending, there's always an issue with the ability of the borrower to meet the cash flow differences. Are you concerned with anyone?
We have no exposure to any marginal field. Marginal field, no, we don't have any exposure there.
Okay, and the last one is, what portion of your FCY assets are, you know, exposed to clients earning in local currency in Naira? There must be a figure to this.
So,
in terms of the portion of our loan in FCY and the local currency, we have about 29% in FCY and the rest is in local currency. And like if I mentioned earlier, for what the exposure we have in FCY, they are largely to customers whose flows are in FCY. So we don't envisage that. What is the current? We don't envisage any currency risk with respect to that.
Okay, and then the trade finance book. How big is the trade finance book?
The trade finance book is massive. I mean, Zenith Bank, in terms of foreign exchange, we control over close to 25% of the market, and these are purely for trade. So we have a massive trade finance book.
And is it entirely documentary or a lot of them are post-import?
No, they are basically for import. They are basically for import, yeah. Documentary credits by way of LCs and BCs.
I'm just asking if you have a portion of it that is already crystallized and is sitting on balance sheet.
So the way trade finance operates, it's either you are doing a confirmed LC from day one or you are doing an unconfirmed LC. At the end of the day, once you've established an LC, there's an underlying liability there. Because what you are basically offering is a trade, is a credit, a line of credit. So at different points, you will have the ones that will crystallize and the customers will buy the foreign currency and make payments.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Adarote of Chapel Hill, Denham. Go ahead, your line is open.
Good afternoon, thank you very much for the call. Please, I'd just like to ask a follow-up question on the non-interest income. I noticed that you reported auction income and foreign withdrawal charges of about 8 billion, which contributed to non-interest income. But that wasn't reported in 2013. So I'd like to know, is this something sustainable or is it something that you think will drive your performance from 2015 going forward? Thank you.
Sorry, can you repeat that question again? It's not gotten very clear, the line.
Okay.
Maybe talk a bit louder.
Can you hear me clearly now?
No, not exactly. Yeah, I think they got an echo at the background.
Hello?
Okay.
Hello?
Go ahead,
I was asking about auction fees income and foreign withdrawal charges. Both of them contributed $8 billion to your non-interest income in 2014. So is this something sustainable? Should we expect both line items to contribute to your earnings from 2015?
Okay, your concern is on our ability to sustain the strong earnings on what we earn on. That's the aspect that has to do with the FS bit of it. One thing is certain, we expect volume of business to increase given the exchange rate now. And we are also steadily looking at new areas of opportunities, new niche opportunities to beef up our income base. So we will say that, yes, on the whole, non-interest income will sustain it by looking at the other areas of fee opportunities as we move along.
Thank
okay,
you.
So, but in particular, the option fees and foreign withdrawals, they were not reported in your 2013 account. So you should... Hello?
So what page are you looking at the presentation?
Not the presentation, but your financial account, page 89. The financial statement. Yes, financial statement.
Yes. Did you say it's auction fee?
I know it is something sustainable.
Are you talking about withdrawal fees on foreign foreign currency transactions?
Foreign withdrawal charges, yes, and auction fees income. That's
foreign withdrawal charges.
Okay.
Normal transactions of auxiliary account.
That will continue. It's a normal that will continue.
Okay.
It's what you private term as FX transfer fees or charges.
Okay.
So it will continue, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, our next question comes from Matthew of Lorium Capital. Go ahead, sir, your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for the call. If I look at page 60 of your financial report, you guys provide the composition of your balance sheet into Naira and then the respective foreign currencies that you deal with. And then you provide a sensitivity about, you know, what would the effect be on your profit before tax if the US dollar moved 10% up or down. Now, if I look at that figure that you provided for 2014, which is about 16.4 billion Naira, that alone on your PBT for the whole year would be 14%. So I just want to know, what was the figure in the current year, in FY14, that boosted your bottom line that was purely due to revaluation gains?
Sorry, can you take the question again? Let me get the value.
Yeah. So obviously at year end you had to revalue your assets and all of your liabilities that are in Forex. And obviously you net long dollars. That would have resulted in a revaluation gain.
Sure.
What was that amount in your income statement?
Yeah, okay. We have revaluation. That's income coming from revaluation. Yeah, I think it's about... Yeah, it was just about 5 billion. I think I would just need to check that off to the account.
About 5 billion, okay. And that is profit after tax. So I'd compare that to the 99.5.
That was profit before tax, yeah.
Profit before tax.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Zaib of Thornburg Investment Management. Go ahead, sir, your line is open.
Hi, yes, two questions. One, I noticed there was a big jump in oil and gas loans in Q4. Was that due to the FX revaluation?
The jump in oil and gas.
Yes, okay. And then the second question was, I noticed that the NPL coverage had been falling modestly. What are the plans for shoring that up going forward?
Well, the NPL coverage, you know, before when we were on NGAP, we were doing above 100%. But from 2012, when we started implementing IFRS, where you now consider collaterals, you know, in determining what your provisioning will be, it's been within that below 100%, and we expect it to be below 100%. It'll be around 90% or thereabouts.
Okay, that's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Nubusi of Stanbic IBTC Pension. Go ahead, your line is open.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for the presentation. I have a few questions. My first question has slightly your view on the upstream oil and gas sector. I'd like to know your view on the break-even price level for the players in this sector. I'd also like to know for your exposures, what if you have any hedge arrangements, and what kind of the nature of those hedge arrangements, and also any other arrangements you have in terms of order to protect yourself from that upstream sector. Then I'm also interested in your view on the downstream sector. Do you think the players will be affected by the devaluation, especially in terms of reimbursement? Subsidy reimbursement from the federal government, we need to consider devaluation based on the exchanges before devaluation. So then also, if you could share your view on the NPL risk for the general commerce sector. That sector seems quite prominent in the banking sector right now. So what would be your view? Do you think you should expect more NPLs coming from that side? And then my last one will be on the real estate and construction sector, which currently generates the highest sectoral NPLs for you. So what's your view on that sector, and what's the issue with that sector right now for you?
Okay, thank you very much. In terms of our view on oil and gas upstream sector, what we say is caution will be the watchword. Yes, we participated in some of the IOC sales, but in terms of our participation, quite a number of them had hedges in place, and these hedges were done at the price hedges that appear reasonably comfortable given what the price of crude is now. We are talking about hedges that were done at a price deck of not less than $90 per barrel. We still have a few that were not covered by hedges, but arrangements are on given the appreciation we've seen in the price of crude lately. However, what is also comforting for us is that for the particular assets we participated in, the focus of the financing model was essentially on the revenue derivable from crude sales. The gas component was not factored into it. And given what we've seen, the appreciation in the demand for domestic gas in the country, gas has now become a major issue. So the gas potential of these assets will now be factored in, and revenue thereon will help to cushion the impact of the drop in crude. Moreover, for these assets, they are all brownfield assets. Some of the investors are already looking at other arrangements, such as farming arrangement and soil risk arrangement, that will enable them to maximize the potentials of these assets without any incremental exposure. In terms of this takes care of our mitigants, really. Besides these mitigants, in all of the assets we participated in, we built up very healthy reserve in the debt service reserve account. So the funding of the debt reserve account is adequate to take care of all the interest service within the moratorium period. We expect that given the next 1 year, when the situation would have stabilized, what we have in the debt service will be able to cushion the repayment obligations as we hold due on interest. For downstream, our view is that as far as the sector is concerned, we don't see any issue to worry about, because in our own case, we have chosen the kind of transactions we fund. We are very much involved in the PMS transaction, and the arrangement in place with the government is such that the players are being reimbursed for exchange rate differential. The only challenge there is that there is delay in the payment of SGN, but even at that, they are equally being compensated for the interest margin to take care of the delay. NPL for general commerce. Well, general commerce is quite broad. When you are looking at the general commerce now, we'll also be looking at the SME and the retail part of it. When you look at the category of customers in that sector, the borrowing culture is not something you say is impossible. So in our own case, what we decided to do is to ensure that whatever exposure we create there, they are properly reinforced. Our culture of choosing and picking will continue to guide us in terms of the exposure we create here. We are profiling the customers and ensure that whatever credit product we put in place, at the end of the day, we are able to see ourselves through. Then NPL for real estate sector. Well, there is a drop in terms of what we have. There's a drop from 20.63 to 10.82. What is clear here is that these are all legacy loans. There are no new additions. So in terms of the proportion to the total NPL, it may look high, but in absolute terms, nothing has changed. In fact, we have even had some recoveries in that area. So we believe that the figures as they are still depict the very, very strong and committed risk management approach that we've continued to adopt. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Okay, our next question comes from Gloria of CSL Stockbrokers. Go ahead, your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. The first question I have is on your deposit growth. We saw a very sharp growth in Q4 related to what had happened in 9 months, and I assume that that growth also came at a cost to the bank because interest expense increased by about 96% or thereabout at Q4. My question is, what's your forecast for cost of funds in 2015? Do we expect it at this rate, considering that TSA should have put a further strain on your deposits? And again, the 11% deposit growth we saw, what portion of that is a result of FX translation? And then on your capital adequacy, what's your current comfort level under Basel II? Because I would have assumed that, you'll have maintained a more conservative dividend payout ratio in 2014, considering capital constraints from CBN, but I see that you still maintain a very generous payout ratio. So what's your comfort level under Basel II? And do you think that capital adequacy level at current levels will restrain your growth in 2015? And then finally, this is a more general question, but maybe you can help since you have some power sector loans. Does the power sector intervention fund completely take away the risk from the bank?
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think your first one on the deposit growth, I'll actually say in terms of FX translation and devaluation, it contributed just about 4% to our total deposit, because basically domiciliary accounts that are affected. Yes, towards the last quarter, we were quite aggressive in terms of deposit growth. We've always been. But you'll find out that it's a function of what's obtained in the market. About that time, you notice that there was actually an increase in cost of funds generally in the industry. And we were definitely not isolated from what obtained in the industry. In terms of capital adequacy under Basel II, yes, we closed at 20%, but talking about comfort level, talking about comfort level, I would actually say we are still in a very comfortable position now. If you look at the minimum provided by central bank, even central bank themselves, they were extremely very conservative in coming up with these figures. If you look at what you are providing for foreign subsidiaries alone, it's 5%. These are small businesses that don't even contribute more than 5% of your total business. But I will say that where we are now, 20%, we are very comfortable, and we believe that we should be able to maintain this type of figure. But in terms of looking at threshold, I'll probably advise 17%. As long as we are above that, we are fine. Talking about the power sector, yes, I won't say that the power intervention will remove all the risk. Certainly not. There are risks inherent in all businesses. And everybody in the power sector, too, they don't face the same risk. Even there are some risks inherent in certain companies themselves. If you don't have a good management, you can't run the business well. So I wouldn't want to box all power companies in the same ring because their conditions and their situations differ. But I would say that the Power Intervention Fund has helped a lot to de-risk the particular sector. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Emily Fletcher of BlackRock. Go ahead, your line is open.
Hi, thanks for having the call. My first question was just around the increase in FX deposits. I'm wondering if you can comment to what extent this was seen across the system in 2014. The second question was just around the shift that you saw towards longer-term deposits, whether you could talk about what was driving that. And the third question is just whether you can talk about the effect on the capital adequacy ratio of further FX moves. So obviously FX has continued to move since year-end, and if it were to continue to move further, can you talk about that, how that would affect your capital adequacy ratio? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, for capital adequacy, if I start from that, well, if we expect that any impact, any growth in loans will definitely have some impact on our capital adequacy. But we're very mindful of that, even in our creation of risk assets. More so the fact that currently in Nigeria we're adopting the standardized approach for computation. So for us as a bank, we believe that there are some hidden capital, considering the kind of customers we lend to. If the central bank advances at the point when they start to a more advanced method of computation or capital adequacy, a bank like Zenith Bank will be able to free up a lot of capital, because we're lending to customers who are highly rated, you know, triple A rated and all that. So for those, the capital provision will be lower, and that will free up some capital. But at the current level, what we need to do is to keep being very, very conscious and cautious in the way we lend, and make sure that at each point when we lend and whatever situations are around, be able to consider that impact on capital. And that is our guiding principle in lending.
And at the current exchange rate, what would your capital adequacy ratio be?
Yeah, at the current issue, it's just very close to about 19 point, just around that 19.5, 19.6. That's where we are currently.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, and we have a follow-up question from Lanray of Primera. Sorry, Emily, did you want to ask a follow-up question?
Just the other question. So can you comment on the increase in the FX deposits? Is that a system-wide issue? And in terms of the shift to longer-term deposits, can you comment on what was driving that?
No, I think on the issue of the FX deposit, the increase, you'll find out that it's actually a deliberate strategy by the bank to ensure that we improve our dollar deposit. And what you find is that of utilization, you use them basically for short tenor trade transactions. And they're quite cheap too. So it was quite easy for us to say, look, let's focus more on dollar deposits. And we took advantage of that, which actually helped us. Talking about long-term deposits, you'll find out that in the industry generally, the deposits, I would even say they are long-term as it is. They are not basically long-term. What you probably have typically in the industry, you probably have between 90 days and once in a while you have 180 days. So that's really what you'll find. But talking about whether it is a trend in the industry, I would say not necessarily. It is more a specific, sorry, it is more of a Zenith-specific strategy and not an industry phenomenon. Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is a follow-up from Lanray of Primera Africa. Go ahead, your line is open.
I have a few things. Just to follow up on some of the things you said earlier. So you mentioned we expect COT to go down to zero, and we haven't really articulated to us what you intend to do to replace that. Is it more of the FX income? And with that, too, what are we seeing there? I mean, the spread that you guys usually enjoy is not there anymore. Is it going to be a case of just increased volume? And also, what do you think is a fair value for the Naira? It's quite interesting to see what, you know, the bankers think on what the Naira should be, particularly post-election. We've seen it 1 year forward yield curve, and the Naira showed around between 230 and 260. But for you, I mean, you guys transact in this area more than us. But what would be your fair value for the Naira going forward? Thank you.
Well, let me address this. On the issue of the COT drop, I did mention that there are other areas. Remember that COT is not just dropping now. It's been dropping from 5 per mil to where we are currently. And I did talk about our commissions on bonds and guarantees, which is even increasing, and we expect that it's going to increase. Loan-related fees are there, even transfer fees and charges, they are there. And from our retail business itself, we are also going to have floats and transaction charges. So we expect that we should be able to cover the drop in COT. Talking about the realistic value of the Naira, currently where we are, I think you can assume that is the realistic value of the Naira as it is, because we are talking of a single market now. We have just one single market. So whatever you find in that market, as at that particular point in time, that is the realistic value. Because really, the value of any currency changes, even in the advanced world. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. So are you expecting, you know, the MPC coming up in about 2 weeks, that nothing will be done to the exchange rate?
But I'm not aware that it's the MPC that really will determine. Because see, the way we are now, we have to appreciate the fact that there's a completely different FX regime. The
right.
market is only one. It's an interbank market. The market will determine the value of the currency and not MPC.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ola of Renaissance Capital. Go ahead, madam. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. My name is Ola Mipo from Renaissance Capital. I have three questions. So my first question is a follow-up question to the cost of funds. Has there been a normalization in the first quarter of 2015? And what is your margin guidance when you compare this to trends in asset yield? My second question is on reclassification from non-interest to interest income in 2014. Was there any reclassification done? And I'm asking this because on a quarterly basis, non-interest revenue appears to be quite volatile. And my final question is on the FX trading income reported in 2013. So in 2014 accounts, it's quite different, very significant difference from the figure recorded in 2013. It dropped from 20 billion to about 4 billion. So I'm just wondering why this happened. Thank you.
Okay, let me quickly, on the FX trading income, there, you will notice there are some reclassification that was done. We needed to break up the trading, the strict trading income, the fees on FX related and all that. So if you look at the financials in details, we've given different notes to show what was reclassified from that line of income and how it was disclosed in the new account. So it's basically a reclassification issue here. That's what happened there. On the cost of funds, yeah, we expect that in 2015, I think it's normalizing to around that 4%. So that's what we're seeing currently. And again, non-interest income too, I think it's just majorly a reclassification that was done.
Sorry, just a follow-up question. What was the reason for the reclassification from non-interest to interest income?
Yes, it had to do with FX-related income, especially the usance-related income. We needed to break it up a bit because some part related to interest, some part related to fees. So we needed to disclose what related to interest to go to interest and all that because they were coming in as one line of income. So that's what we did.
Okay. And just on margins, what are your expectations for margins in 2015?
Yeah, margins, we're giving guidance for margins to be around 8%. That's our NIMs. 8.3%. I think that's the guidance we're giving for 2015. Close at 8.4. Yes.
Next question, please.
Okay. Our next question comes from Luca of Aereo Capital Markets. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Gentlemen, thank you for the questions. You've answered most of what I wanted to ask. I'm just looking for a little bit of guidance on the effective tax charge that we can expect. The reason I'm asking is there's obviously been quite a drawdown on treasury bills and other government securities, so I'm just wondering what the tax consequence is going to be of that. If you could just give me a little bit of guidance for the effective tax rate in 2015. Thank you.
Okay, good. We're going to be giving guidance for around 16% for 2015. If you notice, we had some increase in our earnings as we have profit for this year, but our dividend did not increase if you compare to 2013. So for the same level of dividend for an increased amount of profitability, we expect that will impact tax in some way. So we close with about 17% tax rate for 2014, but so 2015 we are guiding 16%.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yep, there are still 10 left in the queue. The first is from Ibek Islamov of HSBC. Go ahead, sir. Your line is open.
All right. This is Aidek from HSBC. Just a quick question from me. You have disclosure on your loans, fair value of your loans, and the carrying value of your loans as of end of December 2014. And the fair value of your loans actually is about 27 or 25% below the carrying value, reported value. What's the reason for this? That's the question I wanted to ask you. And the second question is, when I compare the ratio of risk-weighted assets to total assets between you and Guarantee Trust Bank, I actually expected you to have a lower ratio of risk-weighted assets to total assets, but it's actually high compared to Guarantee Trust. And what's the reason here?
So can you sorry, please, if you don't mind, can you take those questions again? It wasn't very clear. I think maybe talk a bit louder because of the reception.
Sure, let me repeat the first question. So the first question relates to your note in your annual report. It's note 336, fair value of financial assets and liabilities. So this note actually shows a big difference between fair value of your loan portfolio versus the reported value of your loan portfolio, right? So it's about 20 or 25% lower. So I want to understand the reason why the fair value of the loan portfolio is much less than the reported value. That's the first question. The second question is your ratio of risk-weighted assets to total assets appears to be higher. It's under Basel II, it's 71%. Yeah, 71%, your risk-weighted assets to total assets ratio. When I look at Guarantee Trust Bank, it's actually lower compared to yours. Guarantee Trust Bank reports about 59% risk-weighted assets to total assets ratio. What's the reason here? Why do you have sort of a higher risk-weighted assets to total assets ratio, although you have a more liquid balance sheet compared to Guarantee Trust Bank?
Okay. On the risk-weighted assets, for the purpose of computation of capital adequacy, the difference between two banks would be on the mitigants that each bank would have claimed for the purpose of arriving at that. You know, if you have mitigants or maybe have cash or all that you can use to reduce the risk. So you have that difference between, so even if you're looking at the absolute amount, but the risk weight or the risk weighted asset itself could decrease or increase based on the level of claim or you've done. So that would be the difference between us and
the
city bank.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
Then you were talking about the fair valuation and the carrying value. The difference will be more of a collateral value. That's what will cause that difference. So if you have taken into consideration the collateral, the carrying value will differ from the fair value because in your fair valuation, you consider collateral in it.
Okay. When I look at Guarantee Trust Bank financial statements, there is no difference at all between the fair value of loans and the reported value of loans. So what's that collateral which declined in value in case of Zenith Bank, if you can tell me?
So can you take that again?
Yeah, so you're saying that the difference is the valuation of the collateral, right, which puts the fair value of loans lower. So what's that collateral which declined in value? Can you describe the collateral type?
No, the different collaterals you will consider for the purpose of the loans, you would consider like cash, you consider things like insurance if that's taken or not. It's cash-related kind of things you claim. Some of the customers, that customer has, you know, with you, and that you can use that as a if that is so that those are kind of things you consider as collateral for the purpose of this risk valuation.
And I think it's important to note that Stanley is talking about things that are likely, not in specific terms now, because unless you are seeing what each person has done for you to be able to compare like with like, but he's talking in general terms what will likely affect your risk weighted assets.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Jack Marigi of African Alliance. Go ahead, sir, your line is open.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the call. My first question was the increase in impairment charge in the fourth quarter. The impairment charge in the P&L went up significantly in the fourth quarter. What drove that?
Well, normally in the fourth quarter, that's where you have your auditors come in. You will naturally have differences between our own basis of valuation of what is determined on loans and the auditors. auditors would normally use clearly the objective criteria. We use both because now these are customers we deal with every day. We understand their cash flows, and we could have those little differences will cause some sort of difference between our own provisioning and theirs, and at the end of the day, it's based on that level of risk. So, I mean, it's normal that you see in the fourth quarter you have those kind of increase.
Okay, thanks. And in terms of stress testing of the loan book, I mean, have you carried out stress tests in light of the oil price on the oil and gas book and non-oil and gas book? And what has been the results of those stress tests?
Essentially, we have stressed our book using a 10% and a 20% shock and looking at the impact on NPL and capital raising. It wasn't very significant because the ratio of our provisioning rate now for oil and gas is very low. And if you apply that, it moves us down by about 5% of our current capital adequacy computations. So we don't think it will be very significant if it does occur for a 10% or a 20% shock in NPL. Thank you.
Okay. Lastly, net interest margin, you've guided 8.3%, but in a higher rate environment, I would have expected a higher net interest margin from last year, but it looks like you're guiding for it to remain at the same level despite the higher rate environment. How come?
So if the higher rate is on both sides, if you have higher rate in deposits, you will expect that for your loans, it will be static. You will reprice your loans too. So either way, as far as the bank is concerned, it's our margin that we are after. So that's why we've guided about the same level.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from UK Gavaza of Investec Securities. Go ahead, sir. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for hosting the call. I've just have got three questions to ask you. The first question is in line with the NPL's outlook. I've observed that the average credit rating on your book has actually deteriorated from an average of around double A to almost triple B, and yet you are quite optimistic on the outlook for the NPLs. Would you explain why you are being that optimistic? I think that would be the first question. The second question is on exposure to operating accounts with the CBN. I've observed that your normal operating account, you have about 170 billion sitting with the central bank, which seems to be quite a lot. Would you explain why you have such a high amount with the CBN? Also given that there are now new eligible limits on the central bank's CDF facility. That would be the second question. The last question would be on risk-weighted assets. If you can give me a breakdown between the on-balance sheet risk-weighted assets and off-balance sheet risk-weighted assets as well. Thank you.
Okay, balance with central bank, largely about 508 billion out of what we have there relates to the CRR. That's why you have that level of amount. So ordinarily we won't keep that kind of money with CBN. We'll rather deploy in treasury bills and that. Yes?
I was referring to the 170 billion that is sitting under the normal operating accounts with the central bank. If I compare it to the other banks like your Guaranty Trust Bank, I realize that the amount that you guys have sitting on that account is actually significantly higher than the other banks.
Yeah, but again, you see, the issue is this. That's a point balance we're talking about here. This at the year end. So we'll have some portion of it are earning, some portion, and it's just a portion at the end of the year. So it may not just be what it is. And if you have some FX funding too in it, so that will increase the balance.
Okay, because I also compared that number to the full year 18 number. And I also compared that number to the 9 months number as well. And I noticed that there was actually a trend that in all those reporting periods, that number was significantly higher than the other banks.
Yeah. So it's actually expected to be higher than other banks because from a liquidity perspective, and Zenith is a very large bank. So these are basically transaction money too. And if you look at our volume of clearing on a daily basis, I mean, with all due respect, it's nothing. There's no other bank will be comparing to us in terms of that. But it's important to note that there are quite a lot of transactions that you have to provide for. Our foreign exchange is one.
because we trade heavily in foreign exchange. If we control about 25% of that market, you can imagine what we have to provide for. And prior to now, you know that you are supposed to fund those accounts 48 hours before you submit a bid. So these are the type of things that will contribute to those huge sums. On the issue of the
and you ask on the risk-weighted assets, the on-balance sheet and off. For on-balance sheet, we have about 55%, while the off-balance sheet is under 9%.
Sorry, if you say 9%, are you talking about the risk densities, or you're breaking down the total in terms of the allocation?
This is the allocation to...
Because I think what I wanted to... Okay, let me rephrase the question. If you can provide the risk density for off-balance sheet exposure and the risk density for on-balance sheet exposure as well, the risk density just being the risk-weighted assets as a proportion of the total exposure in terms of the asset exposure.
Yeah. For us as a bank, for on-balance sheet, we'll be hitting about 71%, and off-balance sheet is much lower at about 8 to 9%.
8 to 9%.
Off-balance sheet, yeah, 8 to 9%.
Okay. So as a follow-up question on that, what sort of returns are you getting on those off-balance sheet exposures? I mean, in terms of the gross return on risk-weighted assets on that?
Most of our off-balance sheet items are actually advanced payment guarantees, which are held on behalf of customers who have contracts to do. And as soon as those contracts are done, they are exited from the book because those funds are used to pay down on the portion of the contract that has been done. So they are constantly moving, they grow and they go out as quickly as they come. In some cases, you have cycles of probably 3 to 6 months, and they're out of the
cash backing insurance.
But I mean, if you weight that, I just want to get a sense of the profitability of those exposures. I mean, if I were to weight, you know, the sort of like return that you're getting and the risk, the commensurate risk also that you're assuming, I just wanted to get an indication of, you know, what would be the risk-adjusted profitability of those exposures.
Our balance sheet offers us two things. It's a source of liquidity for us because of the period we hold them before the transactions are done. They form a source of liquidity for us, even though it's short tenured. On the average, we get about 1% on an average off-balance sheet transaction, and we get it flat on every transaction. So if you analyze that, that becomes very significant.
Okay. And the last question on the average rating for your credit book. I'd say that I did a small calculation there, and I observed that it was around double A in 2013, and the weighted rating for that book is now triple B, yet you're optimistic that the NPL outlook will be near flat for 2015. Would you just reconcile the two?
Well, I think that basically the rating, yes, you could have some drop in the rating, but what has happened is that the ability of those customers to repay has not been impaired in any way. They are still making payments on most of the loans that they have, but the rating may be based on the criteria that is set. You know, that's what probably would have affected it. Either would be at the point they've not gotten the updated financials, that could affect the rating of a particular loan, but that doesn't mean that the activity of those loans has any level of impairment. So if the parameters that have been set, maybe the accounts are not out at the point where doing the updated rating and all that, that would have affected them.
Okay, so you are expecting the average credit rating to improve, or you expect it to remain the same? I just want to reconcile, because, I mean, if the broad quality of your credit book is showing a deterioration, but in terms of your outlook, you seem to be more optimistic. There is just a disconnection there.
No. The truth is that the real quality of the asset, the book, is not showing any form of deterioration. But what you're saying is the rating, and as I said, the parameters you set for the rating could affect at the point you're doing your review. If we are rating at a point when the financials were, that carries a post, that's a mark on the rating grid will have, and that could affect the rate, but the performance and the quality, and that's why we're seeing that our loan quality, we're expecting it to increase going forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Okay. Our next question comes from Shi Gao of Wellington. Go ahead, madam. Your line is open.
Hi. So I noticed that in your loan book, so there is a lot of growth in the other sector. Can you tell us a little bit what is in others?
Other sectors?
Others now account for 12% of total, and last year was only 3%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have quite a lot there. You have services there. There's lots of services. Right.
Yeah, we have services, we have staff-related loans, and at the same time, we also equally have some of the retail loans that are heading.
What's the biggest sector, you would say, in there?
In services? So the biggest sector in that?
The biggest in that? Oh, that would be services.
Services, meaning like hospitality?
Hospitalities, internet service providers, advertising, and the like.
Okay. And just so last time when we met, you mentioned that the cash flow assumptions for the oil sector loans are around, assuming an oil price of $55. And so right now, the oil price assumption is around $75, and the break-even of the oil producers are around $55. So right now, given that oil price is below your cash flow assumption oil price, so are we renegotiating the loan terms with the oil sector?
Well, on the oil sector, what you have is that first and foremost, in the model, we made adequate provision to fund the debt service reserve account. And this provision will take care of interest payment within the moratorium period. And the loans were largely drawn in the last quarter, so we are still within the moratorium period. So the interest service has just commenced, and we are able to do this by falling back on the provisions in the debt reserve account. In terms of the break-even price, I think that is relative, because if you look at the actual cost of production in Nigeria, it depends on who you are talking to. Some will tell you they are operating at about $20-$25. Some will equally tell you, yes, at $20-$25, when you factor in other related costs not directly related to the E&P operation, that their cost will be looking at $40-$45. So if you average it, we'll say that in Nigeria, the break-even price will be hovering between $40-$45. But that notwithstanding, what we have also doing now is that, given the appreciation we've seen in the price, those assets that didn't have hedges covering them, arrangements are on for the hedge to be in place. Yeah, the initial hedges were able to do a straight put option, but what we are doing now, given the dynamics we face, we are looking at the three-way call option. So what we are looking at is, for us, the focus is on break-even price required to service our facility. I think that's what will be of concern to us.
So did we restructure any of the loans in the oil sector, or we haven't done any?
No.
There's no need to restructure because, as it were, the moratorium period is still on, and all the financial covenants are being met. So until we get to that point where we see that the financial covenants are challenged, we don't see any reason to restructure. And arrangements are equally on for them, for most of the investors to begin to look at tapping the potentials of the gas reserves in the wells. Like we said earlier, the gas revenue was never factored into the financial model. So by the time we get that in, it will help cushion the impact in the drop in the price.
Even within this period, the DSRA is even adequate to service any interest obligation.
Great, thank you. One last one for me. So it's a follow-up of a previous question. So back to page 60 on your financial statement. So you mentioned that this year the impact on P&L has been 5 billion naira from FX. So where does the 11, the dollar effect of 10% up or down? So this year it's 16 billion and last year was around 12 billion. So how are those numbers derived and why the realized has been very, very much smaller compared to the models?
Page 60?
Yeah.
Page 60, 60, yeah.
Okay, good. You're asking why we have this figure of 16?
Yeah, so the impact of 10% movement in dollar on the statement looks like it should be around 16 billion, but the realized has only been 5 billion. So what has been, why there is a big difference?
Yeah, you need to look at the timing. We're doing a kind of projection for the whole year. And for last year, you will see the period of the impact and the transaction that will take place was a shorter period for last year. You know, most of the dollar was generally very, very stable for most of the year. But for this year, we're saying the impact will be for the whole year. And that's why we're projecting like a larger figure for 20.
Okay, so let me say something. So what we are saying with our projection is that if there's a dollar devaluation by 10% throughout the year, that will be the impact. Now, if it happens just for a quarter, then you have to divide by 4 or thereabouts. So that will give an idea what. So by taking 5 billion, we took care of that portion that was that portion of the period that there was devaluation. It wasn't for the whole period.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do we still have any further questions?
Yes, we still have 5 people in the queue. The next person is George Bodo of Echo Capital with a follow-up question. Go ahead, sir. Your line is open.
Just a follow-up question on FCY liabilities. I just want to get us an idea of the percentage split between customer deposit in terms of FCY, LCY.
Yeah, FCY deposit is about 22%. Of the total deposit.
Okay. And then how much, in terms of FCY liabilities, how much of it was derived from the oil and is being still being derived from the oil and gas accounts, especially in terms of domiciliation?
Well, I think, sorry.
When you are talking of the exposure in the oil and gas, I think is broad. If we're looking at the oil and gas, if we're talking of the upstream assets, that on its own, the cash flows have been properly reinforced. And in terms of what has to do with domiciliation, here we'll be looking at maybe the midstream sector where exposures have been created, reinforced against cash flows that you expect the contractor to, I mean the contract employer to cover. We don't have much of exposure in that regard. What we have done in terms of our mix is the oil and gas exposure upstream comes under 10% of our total loan book.
Sorry, I mean in terms of the receivables that the ring fence receivables, FCY receivables that you collect, in terms of the collection accounts that you get from the overall oil and gas upstream, how much of it feeds into your FCY liabilities?
I think it's not even significant. If you look at our foreign currency liabilities, it cuts across sectors. So it's not really what you would expect that because we have loans in oil and gas that they dominate our domiciliary accounts. They don't. Our domiciliary account, if you look at the distribution, even quite a number of manufacturing companies, they have foreign currency dollars. Some service companies, they have dollars. Even individuals, they have dollars. So it cuts across sectors.
Okay. So you wouldn't place a figure on any of the sectors, like say this is the most dominant source of our FCY liability?
No. It cuts across. We can't say this. Of course, one will probably dominate, but we can't give you the exact sector that will say is the dominant. It will be oil and gas, but I doubt if it is more than 20%, because we have a lot from services, we have some from upstream, and we have some from even up to general commerce. Yes.
And in terms of because it seems like you're having some mismatch in terms of funding your FCY book. How do you manage to? Are you able to take care of the repricing risks, FCY repricing risks?
No, we have absolutely no mismatch in terms of our funding. We have no mismatch. Remember that you don't fund your loan book from your deposit alone. If you look at our Eurobond is not classified as a deposit liability. Those are what you have to look at is to look at all our funding sources, both deposits, that's the domiciliary account, and our non-deposit. Recall also that we have on lending facilities from our multilateral agencies. If you look at our financials very well, other liabilities combined with our deposit liabilities, there is absolutely no mismatch.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and we have a follow-up question from Ronan Cardia of Exotic. Go ahead, sir, your line is open.
Yeah, thank you. Just a question on your asset allocation. In the fourth quarter, we saw a massive reallocation from investment securities and T-bills into interbank assets. If you could just run me through what the thinking behind that was, and is that a temporary situation and we see that reversing through the year, or is that something of a strategic shift?
Yeah, well, the movement you see more from treasury bills, especially CRR, at the point when CRR was increased to 75%, what we do normally is to invest most of our public sector deposits in treasury bills. So that the drop you're seeing in treasury bill line is basically coming from that in CRR. The other one our expectation of the balances from other banks is just normal transactions. Well, I mean, take advantage of any period of increased rate in the market to place money to earn more. That's basically it.
Okay. So there should be a partial reversal this year, this quarter, as interbank rates have come down?
Yeah, well, if interbank rate goes down, definitely we'll move it to other better earning assets. That's what we'll do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Addington of San Lam. Go ahead, sir. Your line is open.
Hello. Good afternoon. I just have a couple of questions with regards to how some of the stuff's getting accounted on your profit and loss account and your NPLs. So my first question is, I've just observed something very strange to me, that over the past couple of years, you've had a minimum income tax expense, which amounts to about 2.5, 2.6 billion every year. This amount has fallen away in 2014. What would be the explanations why this number has disappeared in 2014?
Yes. Well, what is happening here is this. You know, before now, we were earning a lot, because somebody just asked the question about what is happening to our treasury bill line. Because this income, we're getting minimum tax because we have a large volume of treasury bills from which we're earning a lot of income that we're tax exempt. Now, if you notice, our treasury bill line has dropped. So dropping means that our accessible profit, we'll now have accessible profit that's positive. Before now, if you take out all the income earned on bills, bonds, and other, we'll have negative accessible profit for tax purposes, in which case, at that point, you have to declare minimum tax. Now, this year, you will see our volume has dropped, and therefore we'll have to report some line of tax. That's why you're seeing it dropping off.
Thank you.
Okay. So another question is with regards to your non-performing loans, which will be on your footnotes, page 54. I've got a line that I'm not sure I understand what it means. You've got capital markets NPLs of about 16% of the total NPLs. What does this pertain to?
Well, the capital market loan, you see that these are legacy loans relating to exposure in capital market. I've been there 2008-2009, and what we have, this has also been going down. The key thing is that heading is not increasing, and what we also have is
Did you say that this number is decreasing? Because if I look at this on page 54, you had 1.1 billion in 2013, and it has gone up by 327% to 4.8.
Okay, you need to look at it in line with finance and insurance.
Right.
In 2013, most of that part was in finance and insurance. So that has moved. You will see that there's some decrease in finance and insurance. But the impact, if you take it together, you will see that it's decreasing if you combine those two lines.
Okay, I'm a bit confused here. So some of it is margin loans that can be classified into the finance and insurance category. Am I right?
No, you will notice that in 2013 we didn't have this capital market, you know, set out clearly. Like if you look at the bank, so what we've done, there are just few items that were in capital market, but what we've done, we have classified part out of this capital market. I mean, out of finance and insurance, the bulk of the amount was in finance and insurance. We have to break it up. So in looking at this line, you have to combine the two in the 2 years and see that it's decreasing actually.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Ala of Cordos Capital. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call. My first question is on yield on assets. I would like figures for Q4 2014 vis-a-vis Q3 2014. I ask because interest income quarter-on-quarter has been about 9% for 2014, and then we see quarter-on-quarter in 2014, like last quarter, about 36.64%, and we see year-on-year about 26.2%. So I'm just wondering, I'm looking at Q4, like what happened in Q4 that actually caused this this leap quarter-on-quarter. And I'm also thinking, could it be anything that has to do with the NPR that happened in November last year? And also, I would like your guidance for yield on assets as well. My second question is on the trading income. I would like you to shed some light, please, on the 211% increase in trading income and the components. Since you say the T-bills has reduced, then I'm wondering what exactly makes up the bulk of the trading income to about 211%. So was it Forex, Forex, T-bills, and whatnot? And then also, I don't know if I missed this, but I would also like a guidance on cost of funds for 2015. Thank you very much.
I think that your first question, you basically answered that, because for last quarter of 2014, there was an increase in interest rates. So naturally that affected the, if you look at the growth, you will find in terms of interest income, there was actually an increase in interest rate and in the loan volume itself. The guidance for cost of fund, and we did say it's 4%, and on trading income, Mike, you want to take that?
Yeah, for trading income, most of it came from FX trading. Because of the volatility in the market, it gave us opportunity to make some money. So FX trading made a lot more of the total trading income you are seeing. And that's why I accounted for a 211% increase in the income.
Thank you. Any other question?
Yes, we have two questions left in the queue so far. The next is a follow-up from Jack of African Alliance. Go ahead, sir, your line's open.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to clarify what you said on the results of the test, stress test. You said you did a 10 to 20% assumption stress test, and the results were?
What about 0.5% impact on our CAR?
0.5% impact on capital adequacy?
Yes.
Okay, that's assuming a 10 to 20% increase in NPLs.
Yes.
Okay, and is that a worst-case scenario?
Well, we don't expect it to be more than 20% in 1 year. we can do 100, but I don't think that all the loans in the oil and gas upstream are going to go bad. So we just took a 10% increase on a 20% increase, yes.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Okay, and the next question comes from Lara Dada of SBG Securities. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hi, I would like to ask, what's the, to elaborate on the drivers of the year-on-year growth in NPL in the manufacturing, agri-processing, agriculture and consumer credit sectors. Then the second question, we would like you to please provide more color on what was responsible for the material increase in the profitability of the retail business. And will it influence your strategy going forward? Because we noticed it increased from about 66 billion to 82 billion. Thank you.
We saw the drivers of growth in the NPL for manufacturing. Manufacturing didn't grow really, because if you compare to 2013, as a percentage of our total, are you looking at the absolute figure?
Combined and grow with manufacturing.
Okay, combined
it. It's only manufacturing.
Oh, okay, you're looking at the two. Okay, fine. So you're looking at the drivers of the growth. So I think,
it's not really growth per se.
Combined.
You are looking at the change in the composition.
Yeah.
So it's looking like it's moving from, say, 6% to 12%. That is because in some cases repayments have taken place. With repayment taking place, the quantum, the total amount is reduced. But it depends on which sector we had the repayment. What that meant is that First is that for manufacturing and agro business, there are no new additions, but we may not have achieved as much repayment as we recorded in other sectors. So that is why you see that when you look at manufacturing, in the slide, 2013 you have 6.82, then we now combine in manufacturing and agro process, you have 12%.
The combination of
But, okay. but the most important thing is, from the macroeconomic perspective, it's not like oil and gas where you can say this is the specific thing that is causing this. So it is purely obligor-based. So thank you very much. Do we still have anybody on the queue?
Yeah,
sorry, the second question for the retail business.
Well, the retail business, as you asked, and what are the drivers of our performance there, the key thing is, from our retail perspective, what are we really doing? We are providing convenience, and basically most of our revenue for now, they are transaction-based, and the float we even generate from that. We are not too heavy in terms of retail loans for now, but in terms of transaction fees, it's actually improving, and we expect that we will improve further in that particular area. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you very much for your time. We appreciate your coming and phoning in this afternoon, and I want to thank you all. Thank you very much, and all the best.
This now concludes the conference. Thank you all very much for attending. You may now disconnect.